This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Baltimore police officers are on trial, charged with corruption and abuse of power. So massive and blatant, a former police chief compares them to 1930s gangsters. And one of the former political prisoners, known as the Soledad Brothers, is fighting for release on parole.
But first, Amazon, one of the world's largest corporations, has pared down to 20 the list of cities that it is considering for its second world headquarters. The commercial giant claims it will bring $5 billion in investments and 50,000 jobs to the table. The cities and states are, in turn, offering billions of dollars in tax subsidies and other giveaways to Amazon, whose major stockholder, Jeff Bezos, is the world's richest man. We spoke with Greg LeRoy of Good Jobs First, an organization that has fought for decades against corporate bullying of cities and workers. LeRoy says cities always lose out in these mega deals with corporations.
This public auction that Amazon is staging for its so-called HQ2 or second headquarters project is a rare event, right? You know, 99.99% of these competitions are staged privately with code names and secrecy agreements and so on. I think this is only the sixth time in U.S. history that I could point to where we've had this very high-profile public auction. And Amazon sort of wants it both ways, because at the same time they launched this public auction back in September by just putting out this request for proposals and getting 238 bids that they've just whittled down to 20. But then after they whittled it down to 20, they're now saying to the cities left on the list, now we're going to go dark. Now everything is going to be low profile. There's not going to be any public events when we do our site visits. We're going to file another request for proposals that you're going to have to agree not to disclose. Mum's the word. We're going to go back to the old school of secret site location competitions. To me, this is like Amazon trying to have it both ways, because they obviously ginned up a huge amount of public pressure on the finalists by getting 238 bids, but now they want to go back to being able to control everything in the back room.
And by doing this without transparency, it not only has deep implications for the people in the city that finally is chosen, but it's a great precedent for the nation as a whole, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, we've had this war among the states problem for decades. In fact, Business Week coined the phrase the second war among the states 42 years ago. This is not a new issue. This is kind of the way federalism and states' rights play out in economic development. I think the difference today is not only that we've got these huge mega deals like Foxconn and Apple and now Amazon really making this much more public and much more visible. A lot more people are paying attention. But we also have a president who, for the first time ever, has endorsed the war among the states, right? In a speech he made at Carrier a month before he took office in December of 2016, then President-elect Trump basically said, you know, if companies want to play states against each other and get the best tax break deal they can, that's fine with me, just as long as they don't try to go offshore. And then a few months later, we came to learn that Trump not only blessed this war among the states, but then he actually participated in it. He actively helped Terry Gao, the chairman of Foxconn, as Foxconn played several states against each other for the deal that ended up going to Wisconsin. And, you know, Trump personally identified with it. I think Jared Kushner was also involved. Gao was in the White House, and they announced the deal at the White House.
And yet I remember how in his second term, President Obama gave what amounted to an official presidential endorsement to Amazon and its policies and visited one of its centers.
Yes, very little attention has been paid to the working conditions in their what they call fulfillment centers, their warehouses. We've been yelling that not only should there be job quality standards, you know, wage and health care and full-time hour requirements for these places, but also city and state government should stop paying Amazon to build these things. Everybody knows that the prime model, the business model at Amazon, has changed over time. It used to be that they avoided sales tax by having very few warehouses in very few states. But today, because they want to do this rapid delivery, you know, same-day delivery, next-day delivery, two-day delivery, they have to be everywhere. They're building many dozens of fulfillment centers. You know, they have to be close to every major market with lots of prime households. And yet, last year alone, they got 23 tax incentive deals for these places.
And we see that some of the cities that have been targeted or offering themselves up to Amazon are putting forward schemes in which the workers, Amazon's workers, would be paying taxes essentially to Amazon.
Yes, this is a dark trend in economic development. We first called it out by name 6 years ago. We issued a study called Paying Taxes to the Boss, which effectively means that the big source of money in 16 states then, 18 states today, and maybe Maryland, if Maryland enacts this big new package for Amazon, which would make 19 states, essentially the way it works is that the state personal income tax, the withholding tax on people's paychecks, ultimately would end up with the company, in this case Amazon. We think this is terrible policy. It's one thing to reduce the company's property tax, sales tax, income tax. That's the way we've traditionally defined incentives in this country. But now we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel when we're giving them other people's money. And we're doing this without the permission or knowledge of the workers in almost every case.
And this process, this corporate-led process, seems to be reducing a whole host of municipalities to company towns before the company even gets there.
There really is that risk. I mean, obviously, some companies like to be big fish in little ponds. There's some great piece in the New York Times today summarizing a lot of very disturbing literature, which it's not a new finding, but we know that in labor markets that are more monopolized, that is where there's less competition for the work and the wages of workers, wages are depressed. And certainly, if you look at a lot of rural and exurban areas in this country, that's often true, and that's a big reason why there's so much frustration with the economy in red parts of this country, because there's been so much stagnation. We also know that areas that are dominated by a small number of employers exhibit lots of other disturbing socioeconomic trends. This is literature dating back to the 50s done by agricultural economists. So we know, for example, that people in monopolized markets vote less often, go to church less often, have lower life expectancies. All kinds of measures of sort of social well-being and civic participation fall off.
One of the cities on the Amazon top 20 list is Newark, New Jersey, where the biggest corporation, Prudential, already reigns supreme politically. Amazon would become the new honcho in this majority black city.
It would. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of people cheering for the deal, including Mayor Baraka, but a lot of other people in the city concerned about the existing pressures on gentrification that are beginning to crop up in Newark and how the whole process would get managed. $2 billion out of the $7 billion subsidy offer being made to Amazon to locate in Newark, $2 billion are local incentives, that is a local property tax mostly and local sales tax exemptions on top of a big $5 billion package from the state. And if safeguards are not put in place, if the existing residents of Newark do not get a shot at those jobs, we know from lots of studies that the vast majority of job takers will be from someplace else. And they're going to come in and they're going to make a great paycheck and they're going to raise housing prices and raise rents, and that's going to fuel more gentrification there.
That's right, and that gentrification would spread throughout the city and even beyond its borders with something as massive as Amazon entering.
Yeah, I mean, if they're seriously going to hire 50,000 people, and we've always been skeptical of that number, they employ about 40,000 now in Seattle, but even if they hire 20 or 30,000, that's an enormous impact.
And you've calculated that in these types of deals, the actual cost, the cost to the taxpayers of every job that is subsidized, is $658,000.
We have these mega deals, these mostly 9 and 10 figure deals, and New Jersey has given up 13 of these under the former Governor Christie. These mega deals are always losers for taxpayers. That is, if a subsidy package is worth $658,000 per job, which these mega deals are, that means to break even, the average worker in a corporate headquarters, a chemical factory, a microchip fabrication plant, whatever it is, the average worker would have to pay $658,000 more in state and local taxes than public services they and their families consume. You know, so obviously everybody generates public costs, right, including all the newcomers that are going to move in to take the Amazon jobs, right? Their kids are going to go to school. You're going to have to hire teachers and build classrooms and widen lanes and pick up trash. None of those things are free. If Amazon's not paying any income or property or sales tax, guess who gets stuck with those bills?
We've been talking about dollar and cents, numbers, but what about democracy, social democracy, a situation in which the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, can waive his offer and have such an impact on the mega and very specific local lives of people?
It's an astonishing development. So Jeff Bezos owns about 17% of Amazon, which together with other things he owns makes him now the world's richest man, richest person. And this is a new height of sort of hubris, right? We rarely get public auctions for these packages. And Amazon is a very popular company because it's such a consumer, customer-friendly oriented kind of company. So the amount of glowing media in all those locations that bid, that Amazon got, was insane, was incredible. So it's an amazing thing they got. Very little attention is paid to the working conditions in their warehouses. A lot of people forget the damning series that ran in the New York Times about 2.5 years ago about the brutal working conditions, even among the white-collar workers that at Seattle headquarters. There's a great book called The Everything Store by Brad Stone. If you really want to get the backstory on the way this company came to be what it is, it's by far the best book.
But when we use the term oligarchy, which Americans like to put on other countries, that other countries are oligarchies, doesn't Jeff Bezos and Amazon and sagas like this show that the United States is, in fact, an oligarchy?
You know, I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not schooled in the way the literature about how that's defined, but look, let's just tick off some of the big factors people might not be aware of. Amazon is the biggest provider of cloud computing services in the country. It has about a 40% market share. It has big contracts with numerous federal government agencies, including the CIA and some other intelligence departments for Amazon Web Services. The company has many, many other divisions. The company's been on an acquisition spree. It owns lots of other companies, including Audible, the recorded book company, and Zappos, the shoe company, and dozens of other holdings. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, which is arguably, you know, one of the two or three most influential newspapers in the country, especially now with its aggressive investigative reporting posture toward the Trump administration. People like Lina Khan, a scholar in antitrust law at Yale, have written passionately in recent years about the fact that our antitrust laws have not kept up with the high-tech economy and that we have to revisit our antitrust laws. And she uses Amazon as exhibit A for why we've not kept up with the economy, why our laws have not kept up with the economy.
Yes, and in light of that larger situation, we understand that your organization, Good Jobs First, and about 130 others are asking for more transparency for different aspects of this particular Amazon deal. But we've got a much bigger problem with the growth of these billionaires and their political power.
Well, it's really true. And obviously, there's lots of different players here. If you were to bring in the Koch brothers and the network of donors that they have organized in recent election cycles, you know, Bezos has been less public. Well, he has a modest charitable footprint, he and his wife do. They recently gave a bunch of money to a group that provides scholarships for dreamers or people who arrived as undocumented children in the United States. And the company has certainly signaled support for marriage equality and LGBT rights. So it's a funny combination of sort of very bare knuckles tax avoidance, but liberalism on social policies.
That was Greg LeRoy of Good Jobs First.
In Baltimore, a trial is underway of police charged with robbing and extorting citizens, drug dealing, and other crimes and corruption. The former police chief of Baltimore has described the cops involved as behaving like gangsters from the 1930s.
Many believe the case is closely tied to the shooting death of a policeman last year, which led to a multi-day lockdown and siege of an entire neighborhood. Carl Dix is a co-founder, along with Cornell West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. His hometown is Baltimore.
This is especially close to me because I was born and raised in Baltimore and actually grew up only a little bit removed from the neighborhood where much of the activity went down over on Harlem Avenue in the Edmondson Village area over there. And look, what you have here is these cops are part of the Gun Trace Task Force. And this is an elite unit of cops who are touted as being on the front lines of dealing with rising crime in Baltimore. And what these cops are charged with doing is that they rob people. They plant guns and drugs on people. And see, this is something that folks in the neighborhood have been saying has been going down for years, and nobody was listening to them. This time around, what happened was they got caught on video doing these robberies, planting guns and drugs. And partly they got caught on their own body cam video because someone wasn't sharp enough to turn the thing off or erase it. And that played a role in them getting it into court. I mean, and I should say that there's a popular young rapper named Young Moose, very popular in the Baltimore area. He's strictly local, but very popular. He's been especially vocal in calling this out, in part because the police have done it to him. He's got a string of gun charges, and he's been talking and rapping about how the police were setting him up. And this case, they got caught on tape, and it wasn't just, you know, the words of the young black people who were being victimized against the cops, but there was actual video evidence there. And these cops, it's like even worse than gangsters in the 30s, because this was the law doing this to people, the law straight up doing it. And the case that they got caught on and that spun everything out of control on them, they busted a dude on the street and followed him to a place where they say he was doing illegal stuff and he had money and drugs. And the brother did have considerable money there. I don't know how he got it. What they did is they stole most of the money and then filmed themselves coming back into the place and arresting the person and confiscating a smaller amount of money, but then got caught on it. And the thing that's really got them caught up now is that some of the pigs involved in this have pled guilty and are testifying against other pigs. But the approach of the city is to push this aside and say there were a couple of rogue cops, but we caught them. Nothing important here, nothing to look at.
And the suspicion in the community is that the death of the cop, subsequently the police sergeant in that Baltimore neighborhood, may have been connected with the police scheme. That is, that some police were turning evidence.
Yes, because what's not talked about a lot in relation to this cop's death is that he was planning on testifying against these guys. And he was actually not part of their scheme. And in fact, when he found out about it, he complained about it to higher-ups and helped to get the case going. Then he is mysteriously killed. The Baltimore Police Department turns it against the people in Baltimore, locks down the neighborhood, which is something that they have done for decades. That goes all the way back to my youth, where they would lock down a whole neighborhood if something happened that they didn't like. And the whole neighborhood suffered collective punishment and ignored the fact that who was really benefiting by this guy's death were the cops carrying out this dirty deeds among the masses. And interestingly enough, the police department wasn't especially interested in investigating it. A call was made for the feds to come in, for the FBI to investigate it, and the FBI refused to do so. which tells us something about this. Now, there's something to be said about the defense theory in this, what defense the cops are putting forward. One defense is, well, we were just following orders, which, interesting, but the orders were clearly illegal, because if a higher-up cop is telling you to go rob people and plant guns and drugs on them, you should be pretty clear that he's giving you illegal orders, and carrying them out means that you should go and he should go down with you. One of the cops, though, has an interesting approach to it. He says, well, it's not really robbery because we were taking the money from people who gained it illegally, and it only becomes wrong when we didn't turn it in. And the reason he's making this argument is that a charge for not turning in property that you've confiscated is like a technical violation, and it makes it a much lesser charge facing much lesser time.
But of course, if that is the case, then you were still acting as an agent of the state, and the Baltimore Police Department did the robbery.
Yeah, I was going to say it will be interesting to see if that attempt to move it works and whether people follow the implications of that. Because if you allow him to reduce his charge, then you're actually saying this was an overall state operation, which is in fact what it is. And see, it's very important for people to look at this right now for its overall implications, because we're not just talking about some bad cops in one neighborhood. We're talking about the frontline enforcers of the state machinery who have criminalized and demonized a section of people, young black people, that this system has no future for. And that's what we're up against here. And this criminalization and demonization has been going on nationwide and is still happening. The Washington Post put out a report on police killings, and police killings last year were slightly higher than the year before, including the killings of unarmed people who were doing nothing wrong, and police getting convicted for outright murdering people remains at almost nothing. I think one cop got convicted last year, and that was the cop who shot Walter Scott in the back in South Carolina as he fled. So this is what we're up against, and we need to put that together with the fact that the Sheriff-in-Chief and his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, keep saying we got to take the gloves off the police. Now think about it. These cops ain't got no damn gloves on. And when they say they want to take the gloves off the police, they're telling you they're going to be unleashed to bring down more brutality and murder, and particularly targeting black and brown people.
But it should also be said that, as you pointed out, these things have been going on in Baltimore and cities across the country routinely for decades, pre-Trump.
Exactly. No, that's the case. Trump did not start this. More his intentions around this are to intensify it as part of dealing with a dangerous section of society from the perspective of the capitalist imperialist rulers of this country. They got no future for black people. They can't profitably exploit them anymore. And despite Trump's talk about he's going to bring jobs back, et cetera, that's another one of those lies that he told. So their only approach to this is we have to clamp down even harder on people who we don't like, have hated all along, but who we also fear, because they remember what the response of black people in the not too distant past has been to the exploitation and savage oppression that this system has brought down on them.
And in this case, it's the worst kind of poetic injustice, in that with the revelations on this apparently massive criminality in the Baltimore Police Department, we see that the result is a crackdown on the very community that's been victimized, these police, with people not even allowed to go back into their homes and relatives being allowed to visit their neighbors for a number of days.
Yeah, see, and that's what they did to this one neighborhood. But the other thing to put it next to is that right now, the Baltimore Police Department is talking about it has to be stricter with its zero tolerance for crime policies and its broken windows policing. And when they say that, they don't mean zero tolerance for crimes committed by the police against the people. They mean more stopping and frisking people. They mean more busting people on BS charges like loitering. And they have this novel approach where they bust people and say that we caught them acting with the intent to commit a crime in the future. What they mean by that is when we busted this young man or young woman, they were in the course of casing a place that they might come back and rob later. You were out on the street and they grabbed you. And then they said, well, you were casing this place we grabbed you in front of.
We also know that this particular group of cops carrying around ski masks and crowbars and grappling hooks and other tricks of the criminal trade, but they also carried around BB guns that they would use to plant on anybody that they might shoot.
Yes, and see, the implements that you talked about them having, that was actually part of their job, supposedly, because it made them more efficient at breaking into places and things like that. And none of that was deemed illegitimate. In fact, nothing they did was deemed illegitimate until they messed up and got caught on video. And that is what people really need to zero in on. These cops were doing their job until the video surfaced. And their job was getting young black people, because that's who they target in Baltimore. It actually turns out that while black people are the majority in Baltimore, they're not the only racial group present, but they are the only racial group that got arrested for marijuana possession in the year 2017. So you either have to believe that black people are the only people smoking weed, or the legal system is directed towards criminalizing black people, and especially young black people, who are mostly who gets busted for weed.
So we have a black majority in Baltimore, an overwhelmingly black elected government, and in many of these police corruption and criminality cases, majorities of the police involved are black, and yet white supremacy reigns in Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, black faces in high places was never a strategy that was going to end the oppression of black people. It just meant that black people had risen up and said, we're not going to take being subjected to this racism anymore. And the system figured out that if they brought forward some black faces, they could cool people out and confuse them as to whether it was still going down. Because white supremacy did not disappear even upon the election of a black president. That's something that I spoke to, and you and others as well, in the Obama years. So there is a difference in that you have an open, naked white supremacist in the White House and one who is working to bring forward a white supremacist base. But putting a few black faces in high places in the context of a capitalist imperialist system does not in any way undercut the vicious white supremacy that gets enforced. And in this particular case, the majority of the cops in this case and in this unit of this elite gun trace task force were in fact black cops.
In 2015, Baltimore was one of the bright lights of resistance. What's the state of resistance in your hometown, Baltimore, today?
Well, there is an ebb in that resistance, not an ebb in the anger about the mistreatment, but people don't know what way to go forward. And that has led to that. It's not that there is no one there working on it and trying to bring stuff forward, but you don't have people who are reaching in amongst those right on the front lines of being up against this and bringing forward a strategic approach that could unleash their desire to get out from under it. And that's a problem not only in Baltimore, but a whole lot of other places as well. And it's a task that the revolutionary movement's got to take up. I mean, from my perspective, we have to link this with all of the other assaults that are coming down, and in particular, the assault on immigrants that's being brought down by the Trump-Pence regime. Because when the president of the country starts talking about whole countries, and you know he means black and brown countries, they're not going to stop at whether or not the black and brown people they're messing with have citizenship or not. You know, like first they might come for the black and brown immigrants, but we remember that Hitler went stage by stage. So you can't say, oh, they didn't come for me first, because they'll be coming at you later unless you stand up and stand together to stop this stuff.
Well, some of us have observed that they're still coming for black people first when you look at the numbers.
No, they never stop coming at black people. But what I hear among a lot of folks is, a lot of black folk, is that the way in which it's right out on Front Street that they're going at the immigrant population, then you have folks, I mean, you even have folks who have platforms, like Dave Chappelle's response to Trump's election was, well, this is somebody else's problem. We're going to stand back and watch it go down. And the point is, you might stand back and watch it, but it will keep coming down on you. It never stops.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
A group of law students at the Southern University Law Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has appealed to the United Nations Human Rights Commission on behalf of John Cluchet, a 75-year-old California prison inmate who was known in the early 1970s as one of the Soledad brothers, along with George Jackson and Fleeta Drumgo. The men were charged but acquitted in the death of a prison guard. The Southern University law students and their legal advisor, attorney Angela Allen Bell, say California Governor Ed Brown is wrong in trying to reverse the state parole board's decision to release Cluchet, who's been serving time on a later murder conviction. They want the Human Rights Commission to consider the long history of state dirty tricks and frame-ups against black political activists in the U.S. John Cluchet, however, was not a political prisoner when he was first locked up in 1966. Ryan Thompson, one of the authors of the appeal to the UN Human Rights Commission, explains.
While he was in jail for that burglary, he met a man by the name of George Jackson. George Jackson is the founder of the Black Guerrilla Family. While he was in prison with Brother Jackson, there was a guard that was killed. This was allegedly in retaliation for a black inmate who was killed in Soledad Prison. Once that guard was then killed, him along with Fleeta Drumgo were then given the title of the Soledad Brothers for that, because they were put on trial. While they were in trial, as your listeners probably know, some know the story that you had George Jackson's brother and several other Black Guerrilla Family members attempted to break them out. They were known as the San Quentin Six. You had a DA that was severely injured. You had a judge that was killed. And you have Angela Davis, who was then tried for that as well. After that, George Jackson was then killed in an alleged, I say alleged because they say that he was attempting to break out. Some believe that he was set up, and he was subsequently killed in that attempted prison break. Shortly after that, Brother Cluchet and Fleeta Drumgo was found not guilty by an all-white jury of the killing of the guard and found to have no involvement in the San Quentin Six attempted breakout. He was then paroled shortly after that, but as fate may have it, he was then convicted of the murder of a Mr. Robert Bowes and an attempted cover-up. He has always alleged that he did not have anything to do with the murder of Robert Bowes, but he did participate in the cover-up. So that's where we're at now. Brother Cluchet has been spent decades in prison, not for the Soledad incident, nor was it for the Marin County court breakout. He is in prison, and we believe that he has served his time for the Robert Bowles murder. However, after being given parole by a parole board several times, it is worth noting that this parole board is made up of several different individuals. It's in bock, as we say, in the legal community, where people have in a variety of backgrounds, from sociology, anthropology, criminal justice. There are some lawyers on the committee, and they have saw fit several times to grant Mr. Brother Clouchet a parole. However, because of the California Constitution, which grants the governor, that governor now being Governor Brown, he has the power to revoke that parole. And that's where we are at today with that situation, where he's been granted parole again several weeks ago here in the new year of 2018. And we are subsequently waiting to see if he will revoke that again.
You and other law students at the Southern University Law Center are trying to intervene in this case on John Clouchet's behalf with the assistance of a law professor, Angela Allen Bell. Tell us what you want to accomplish, how you think you can successfully intervene.
Last spring, we took a course at the Southern University Law Center headed by Angela Bell, as you mentioned. The name of the course was Law and Minorities. This is a restorative justice class where we look at other means of seeking justice for individuals. Case in point, last spring, 2016-17 school year, I was contacted by the professor. She knows that I'm from California, and she said, hey, I have a case. She receives cases or letters from around the country, sometimes around the world, where people are looking for her help and seeking some form of restorative justice. One of the projects, as you know, there were two students killed on Southern University's campus. Some students took that on, and they have now been awarded their degrees after that. Our case that we took on was Brother Clouchet's case, was to seek another remedy, and that remedy being going to the United Nations. We decided to use the United Nations because we felt that, because obviously Brother Clouchet already has a lawyer that's going through the U.S. criminal justice system, Keith Whiteley, we decided to go the international route because, as your listeners may know, in terms of people of African descent here in the United States, there's always been international pressure that has helped us push things forward or seek some form of justice. And we also believe that in the restorative justice framework, that it has a more complete, quote unquote, resolution in terms of not only making the victim whole, but also seeking justice for the alleged perpetrator, this case being Brother Clouchet.
In effect, John Clouchet is being denied parole on his murder conviction because of crimes that the governor, Ed Brown, says he committed back in 1970.
Yes, it's interesting that when you look at the governor's reason for why he is illegally detaining Brother Clouchet, he says that Brother Clouchet has not seemed to be remorseful for the crimes that were committed back in the 70s under the Black Guerrilla family. Your listeners should know that Brother Clouchet has not received a write-up since 2008, and that write-up at that time was because he would not go into cell with a known BGF member. So the parole board, as people should know, he's 75 years old. The parole board has deemed that he is not a threat. He has been rehabilitated. He is a model inmate in there and being a leader for the younger inmates inside the prison. But Governor Brown seems to want to make him pay for crimes that he was never committed, things that he has said that he's never been a part of, which is the BGF. And more importantly, we believe that he is trying to pin things on him to have him pay for Brother George Jackson's alleged involvement in the breakup in Jonathan Jackson. But again, the parole board said that there's nothing to the allegations of him being a part of the BGF. In fact, there was an amicus brief filed on his behalf by his attorney, and that amicus brief, the appeals court came back and said that, in fact, the information that the governor used in his decisions to revoke his parole should indeed be removed, and they were indeed not true to the point to where there was no information or evidence to support Brother Clouchet ever being a part of the BGF. It was all confidential informants. And in fact, what we believe is that there is a hint of COINTELPRO to be involved in Brother Clouchet's case.
Yes, he was acquitted in the death of that Soledad prison guard, and no one ever alleged that he'd been part of the Marin County courthouse shootout. And it's inconceivable that he would have been paroled in 1972 if there was any evidence that he was part of the Black Guerrilla family.
This is true. And so that's why we decided to go to the International Human Rights Court for that reason, to seek some form of remedy for Brother Cruz. Well, not some form, the form, which is to have him released immediately, because it seems that the criminal court in the United States wants to write briefs or decisions, but yet the governor seems not to want to listen, or there seems not to be any type of pressure from within inside the United States to have Brother Clouchet released.
And what you guys maintain, and what John Clouchet maintains, is if this kind of innuendo and other pseudo-evidence can be used to deny him parole, then he'll never get parole. And so we have to get rid of the use of this kind of evidence.
Not only the evidence that is inside of his file, but we believe that the unfettered, unchecked power that the Governor Brown has in California is too ambiguous, right? He has this, essentially, this iron hand, or the iron pen, we should say, to where he can simply revoke someone's freedoms, liberties, without really giving a valid excuse.
What's the timeline on this case?
Well, in terms of us, like I said, we filed with the International Human Rights Commission, and we should be hearing something back from them shortly, probably within the next few months. This was maybe about 8-9 months ago we filed this, but, you know, they're kind of slow. In terms of Brother Clouchet, he has been granted parole by the California Department of Corrections, and the governor has about 4 months to give his response on a yay or nay, whether or not he's going to continue to indefinitely detain Brother Clouchet. So what we're hoping is your listeners and anyone who wants to get involved would participate in the campaign that we've put together, where we email the governor. You can give the governor a phone call and let him know that we are paying attention to this, and that what he is doing is indeed a violation of Brother Clouchet's human rights.
And what you're saying is that the governor of California is the one who's resurrecting COINTELPRO in the 21st century to deny Clouchet his parole.
That's exactly what we're maintaining. As you know, and some, I'm sure your listeners are aware too, is that we maintain that we believe in evidence supports, if you look at the documents that we submitted to the United Nations, that COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, and some of his field agents were indeed involved in this. And we believe that it may not be called COINTELPRO anymore, but there are still remnants, if not a program similar to COINTELPRO, just by another name. So, yes, he is carrying out a long tradition of repression, oppression, and tactics that COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover used to carry out, even though he proclaims himself to be a liberal.
So Brown is trying to score political points in the case of a person who said that he was never, in fact, that political a prisoner.
Indeed, Glenn, what you should know is while we were doing our research on the case too, before we decided to actually take the case on, we were watching video of Governor Brown. He was, I believe, was at the COP conference about climate change, and he was tooting his own horn about just how progressive he and the other officials in the state of California were. And we were just like, wow, you know, how does someone go around the world proclaiming to be so forward-leaning and progressive, and yet at the same time has a political prisoner that he has direct control over in his own state?
And have you guys been in personal contact with Brother Clouchet?
I have not personally had a conversation with Brother Clouchet. He does have communications with his attorney, Mr. Wadlin. He also has communications with Professor Bell. Professor Bell relays the message to us that he's in good spirits, not in the best of health. But yes, to answer your question, no, I don't personally have any contact with him formally, but he does send letters from time to time, and he does let us know that he is doing well, and she writes him back. I think your listeners should know that a lot of times we have these freedom fighters and political prisoners, for lack of a better term, that are still imprisoned and paying the cost for something that was done decades ago in terms of fighting for our freedoms. And so it's my generation's task to ensure that we let them know that they are not forgotten, and we let the state or whatever apparatus that is oppressing them know that we intend to fight for our brothers and sisters that are still being oppressed in this country.
That was law student Brian Thompson of the Southern University Law Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
For decades, and especially in the last several years, the U.S. corporate media has been full of tales of Russian meddling and aggressions against the United States. But much of the world sees a very different picture. Phil Boleto is editor of the Virginia Defender and a member of the Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Bases, which recently held a national conference at the University of Baltimore. Boleto says all the talk about supposed Russian provocations is a propagandistic distraction from Washington's own long history of attempting to militarily strangle Russia.
When the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was founded on April 4, 1949, it had 12 members, the U.S. and Canada, and 10 Western countries. By then, the wartime cooperation with the Soviet Union was long over, and NATO was essentially an anti-Soviet political and military alliance. 6 years later, as a counterbalance, the Soviet Union formed the 9-member Warsaw Pact, formerly the Treaty of Friendship, Cooperation, and Mutual Assistance. That alliance was dissolved in 1991, 10 months before the formal dissolution of the Soviet Union. By then, the U.S. had assured the Soviets that NATO would not be expanding eastward. U.S. officials now deny that, but this is from the Los Angeles Times of May 30th, 2016. Quote, in early February 1990, U.S. leaders made the Soviets an offer. According to transcripts of meetings in Moscow on February 9th, then Secretary of State James Baker suggested that in exchange for cooperation on Germany, the U.S. could make, quote, ironclad guarantees, unquote, that NATO would not expand, quote, 1 inch eastward, unquote. Less than a week later, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev agreed to begin reunification talks. No formal deal was struck, but from all the evidence, the quid pro quo was clear. Gorbachev acceded to Germany's Western alignment, and the U.S. would limit NATO expansion. Far from limiting NATO's expansion, the U.S. vigorously promoted it. In 1999, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland were admitted into NATO. In 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia all became NATO members, followed in 2009 by Albania and Croatia and Montenegro this past June 5th. So today, NATO has expanded to 29 member countries, with 13, nearly half, either former members of the Soviet bloc or part of the former socialist state of Yugoslavia. All new members admitted into NATO since the collapse of the Soviet Union are in Central or Eastern Europe. From a North American and Western European alliance, it has become a North American and all-European force that has moved steadily eastward right up to Russia's borders. And John, thanks for leaving the slide up, because this really shows that the countries in dark are members of NATO, the countries with the slants, Ukraine and Georgia, which are on their way to becoming members of NATO. In 1992, 6 post-Soviet states, Russia and the much smaller countries of Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, signed the Collective Security Treaty, or Tashkent Treaty. One of those, only Russia, is a major military power. In NATO, the United States, United Kingdom, and France together possess a total of 7,315 nuclear weapons. Russia is believed to have a total of about 7,000. But in terms of overall military power, Russia's military budget in 2016 was just over 8% of the combined total of all NATO countries and just over 11% of the United States alone. This is important because one of NATO's founding principles is that an attack on any one member country is to be considered an attack on all NATO countries. Today, Russia is faced with a massive military and political alliance that includes Estonia and Latvia, 2 of the 5 countries on Russia's western and southern borders. Georgia, which borders Russia's southern flank, is not yet a NATO member, but has been accepted for membership pending meeting certain internal reform requirements, privatization. Meanwhile, according to the NATO website, quote, Georgia has provided valued support for NATO-led operations in Kosovo and Afghanistan. Belarus and Russia remain allies, and in September 2016 carried out joint military exercises in Belarus, well within its borders, with Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Ukraine. But this is how the exercises were reported by National Public Radio. In one of the biggest shows of military might since the end of the Cold War, Russia and Belarus are conducting joint maneuvers on NATO's doorstep.
Whoa.
Where the exercises are prompting jitters in some former Soviet satellites. Much less well reported is the rapidly increasing military cooperation between the U.S. and Ukraine, including in the Black Sea, which borders both Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine is not yet a member of NATO or the European Union, but its Western-oriented president, who was installed in a bloody U.S.-backed coup in 2014, would like it to be, and has recently announced that a referendum on the question will be held soon. Meantime, the country is acting as a NATO member in all but name. Every year, U.S. soldiers are in Ukraine taking part in the annual multinational military exercise called Exercise Rapid Trident. This past year, U.S. participation with some 400 soldiers was the largest ever. Every year, the U.S. Navy leads an international flotilla of warships in and around Ukraine's Black Sea coastline as part of an exercise nicknamed Sea Breeze. Last year's operation was also the largest ever, including approximately 800 soldiers from various U.S. military branches. And on an ongoing rotating basis, members of the National Guard from a number of U.S. states are in Ukraine training Ukrainian soldiers in combat roles, headed for Donbas. I want to read you a notice that was posted yesterday on the official website of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. Quote, Ukrainian Naval Aviation and the guided missile destroyer USS Kearney underwent joint training in the Black Sea. The aim of these maneuvers was to work out cooperation under NATO standards and increase the interoperability. Following the scenario, two Ukrainian helicopters landed on the deck of the USS destroyer, USS Kearney, docked in Odessa port, January 8th to 11th. Think about that. It'd be like Russia and Mexico carrying out joint military exercises in the Gulf of Mexico so they could cooperate in time of war. Further, the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2018 authorizes $500 million to provide military aid to Ukraine, including for the first time what is called defensive lethal assistance. This comes on top of what the Reuters news agency reports has been $750 million in non-lethal aid, such as uniforms and radars, since 2015. These exercises, training missions, and military are always described as, quote, defensive in nature, meant to help Ukraine protect itself against alleged Russian aggression. But it's not Russia that's expanding its military influence right up to the borders of the United States. It's not Russia that has built a military alliance that now includes 29 countries moving ever closer to its declared adversary. Members of the U.S. Congress and the media accused Russia of meddling in the last U.S. election, but the U.S. did more than meddle in Ukrainian politics. It overthrew the country's president with the help of neo-Nazi organizations that have unleashed a reign of terror in the east from Odessa to Donbas. I saw members of these fascist organizations myself on May 2nd, 2016, when I traveled to Odessa with anti-war activist Bruce Gagnon, who's here today, and Regis Tremblay. We were there as international observers at the second anniversary memorial for the victims of a fascist mob at the city's House of Trade Unions. That was less than 3 months after the coup, and neo-Nazi organizations were violently suppressing anti-coup forces. On May 2nd, the fascists drove a much smaller group of opponents into the trade union building and set it on fire. At least 46 people died from the flames, smoke inhalation, gunshot wounds or beatings, and to this day there has never been an international investigation of this atrocity because the Ukrainian government won't allow it. As preparations were being made for the 2016 memorial, organizations like the Azov Battalion, Right Sector, and the Brotherhood were threatening to attack those attending the event with machine guns. The members of the Azov Battalion had shoulder patches featuring the yellow lightning strike of a former Nazi SSS unit. The battalion has since been incorporated into the Ukrainian military, while Right Sector, at the invitation of the Ukrainian government, has participated as an independent militia in the fighting in Donbas. They were held back that day because 3,000 Odessans, of all ages came out to Kulikovo Pole Square and held their memorial despite the death threats. And they stayed there for 14 hours on that Memorial Day. When we returned to the U.S., we founded the Odessa Solidarity Campaign, which includes Ray, Bruce, Anna Brie, and myself. And you can find us on Facebook at Odessa Solidarity Campaign or at odessasolidaritycampaign.org. What we are told on this side of the pond is that the problem in Ukraine is Russian aggression. What we don't hear is that the present crisis is a direct result of the U.S.-promoted right-wing coup of 2014. Or that the coup was just part of the overall strategy of U.S. imperialism to reduce Ukraine to a vassal state and staging area for its own aggression against Russia, which is rapidly increasing. I don't believe the real danger here is a war between the U.S., NATO, and Russia. I think the expansion of NATO and increasing U.S. control over Ukraine is meant to both intimidate Russia and force it to increase its military spending at the expense of domestic needs, which inevitably leads to internal tensions. For example, Russia's 2016 military outlay of $69.2 billion was an increase of 5.9% over the year before. Meanwhile, in 2016, the U.S. spent about $597 billion, almost as much as the next 14 countries combined. In 2015, the U.S. accounted for 37% of the world's total military spending. This was the strategy the U.S. under President Ronald Reagan followed with great success against the former Soviet Union. Today, the strategy has been refined. Today, the U.S. and an array of allied non-governmental organizations or NGOs seek out, train, and generously finance internal dissidents who then build mass movements by raising charges of corruption and undemocratic rule. The original charges may be correct, but the political movements they generate quickly become campaigns to replace the government with more Western-oriented ones that promote neoliberal policies of privatization, deregulation, social austerity, and so-called free trade. Progressives who can recognize this strategy in Venezuela and Cuba sometimes become confused when the same strategy is applied to Ukraine, Russia, or Iran. Sisters and brothers, we have our work cut out for us. We need to take this information to the working people of the United States and all the countries of the world. We need to show how imperialist aggression abroad is intimately connected with attacks on working people and communities of color here at home. Hopefully, whatever initiatives come out of this conference will reflect those concerns.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.